Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. A new book about Malcolm X making news for a different interpretation of his life and death. Just to whet your appetite, here is Malcolm X speaking on the unity of African nations in the United Nations on March 29th, 1964.
By having independence and the right to vote in the political world body, it has enabled the dark nations to band together and use the strength of their ballot to force the wealthy nations, which are the white nations, into giving more independence to other nations who are still under their jurisdiction. You and I have to look at this and understand this, that the ballot is as powerful as the bullet.
That was Malcolm X speaking in 1964 at the Audubon Ballroom in Washington Heights. On February 21st of the following year, he would be assassinated in the same building. Fast forward to today and the release of Manning Marable's Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, officially released yesterday. Sadly, Marable passed away unexpectedly on Friday. He was an esteemed historian at Columbia University, a guest on this show numerous times, and joining me now to discuss Marable's final work is Michael Eric Dyson, author of his own book on the civil rights leader, Making Malcolm, The Myth and Meaning of Malcolm X. Professor Dyson, welcome back to WNYC.
Mr. Lehrer, always good to be on your show, my friend.
Let's start with the assassination. In the book, which you have read, Marable asserted that the NYPD and the FBI knew about Malcolm's impending assassination. The NYPD has already denied it. Can you make that case? Or do you believe it?
Yeah. Look, the FBI knew about several attempts on Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and never warned him, never intervened, never tried to protect him, never offered him coverage against the impending inevitability of his own death by some kook or lunatic fringe. So why is it impossible for us to believe that a figure like Malcolm X, even more loathed by members of the FBI and law enforcement, would reach out and warn Malcolm X, since they had him under heavy surveillance, that he was the victim of a coming attempt, and in fact, the assassin could achieve what the law enforcement agency couldn't necessarily legally do. So I'm not certain why it's so difficult for people to believe, especially in 1965 and in the mid-60s, that when we had such racial conflagration, that this could be something really to occur, and that now, these many years later, it's hard for us to believe.
How good do you think Marable's evidence is for trying to prove this? I know one quote that's been making the round is former NYPD detective Jerry Fulcher told Manning for the book that law enforcement, quote, had a mentality of wanting an assassination, unquote. But that's a mentality, that's a predisposition, if true. Is there evidence?
Well, I think that, you know, Manning's point was by piecing all this together, there's no one who's going to come out and say, yeah, of course we knew that Malcolm X was being targeted and the assassin's bullet would not be an impediment to our goals. To expect that is to expect that injustice would not have existed to begin with. When we look at the copious evidence of police intervention, surveillance, harassment, penetration of what they consider to be dangerous groups like the Nation of Islam. And we do know, by the way, Brian, that, you know, the head security person or one of the leading ones in Malcolm's new organization was an FBI plant, the Bureau of Special Services there, right? Mm. So, again, the heavy penetration, the fomenting of dissent, the creation of chaos in these groups, which was the plan, the FBI has admitted that. So it's pretty remarkably convincing to me after you know, looking at the entire book and especially looking at that section, that it's reasonable to believe that this police person's comment is absolutely right, and it's even more reasonable to conclude that they knew what was going on and just turned a blind eye to the whole proceedings.
You were quoted in the New York Times on Saturday as saying that Marable has saved Malcolm X from, quote, both the hagiography of uncritical advocates and the demonization of undeterred critics. What about the first part of that? Does he take down the Malcolm legacy in some important ways?
No, I think he broadens it. I think he takes down the iconic status that was rooted in a romantic, idealistic portrayal that no human being could possibly meet. The same has been done to King, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington. No human being can possibly live up to all of the hype that has been generated around them as a heroic figure, especially posthumously. Martyrdom seems to sweep away the contradictions and conflicts of one's life and neatly resolves them into a pleasant bow of nostalgic memory. And while Malcolm X was an amazing human being, he's even more amazing in light of the flaws he had, the impediments he had to overcome, the obstacles he had to scale in order to become who he was and deal with life as both intellectually, respectably as he could, and as well as looking at some of the tensions and conflicts and contradictions he had in his personal life. That doesn't reduce Malcolm X. That makes him bigger. That makes him broader. That makes him more accessible. You know, we tell young people to look at these figures in history to learn something from them. Well, they feel that, well, I can't possibly learn from a guy who never made a mistake, from a man who was so seamlessly melded into the, horizon of greatness that I could never imagine myself standing up and measuring up. Well, you may never measure up, but you can achieve or at least attempt to achieve some of the same things that Malcolm X did. And I think that Manning Marable's brilliant biography helps us achieve this complicated, nuanced vision of Malcolm, more complicated and nuanced than we've ever had.
Michael Eric Dyson with us talking about the new Manning Marable biography of Malcolm X that just came out yesterday. The Columbia professor Manning Marable and the author passed away just before the release a few days ago. So you talk about Malcolm's failings. A failing newly asserted in this book is, of all things, that Malcolm inflated his early criminality. How so, and what did he have to gain by doing that?
Well, yeah, I guess rappers aren't the first ones, huh?
Badge of honor.
Yeah, I guess singers, not that Francis Albert Sinatra ever inflated the itinerary. But, you know, look, that's par for the course in American society. People tend to exaggerate their childhood failings, especially in this case. More specifically, in regard to Malcolm X, he could exaggerate what he did on the streets to prove just how great Elijah Muhammad's redemptive power was. The worse he was as Malcolm Little, the greater Elijah Muhammad's reputation could become for making him into Malcolm X. So the hustling he did and all the other stuff he claimed to have done, even though he was in Lansing at a time, he said he was in New York doing certain kinds of things. He certainly was a hustler. He certainly did some things that were illegal that landed him in jail. But the reality is that the exaggerated and bloated itinerary of a hustler is to assert the legitimacy of the spiritually transformative powers of the Nation of Islam, especially the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So that was the purpose of exaggerating that street agenda in order to assert the greatness of Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam.
Marable also takes down a peg the iconic book, the autobiography of Malcolm X, which, of course, was not an actual autobiography. It was written by Alex Haley.
Right.
Marable writes, in many ways, the published book is more Haley's than its author's.
Right.
Why, and have you had the same criticisms?
Yeah. What Marable shows us is that several chapters were excised by the amanuensis, by the secretary, by the as-told-to author, the great Alex Haley. And Marable's argument was he's a liberal Republican and maybe some ideological resistance to the notion of black nationalism and a preference for integrationism led him to cast aside these chapters that talked about the Organization of Afro-American Unity, that talked about Muslim Mosque Incorporated, that talked about his work outside of the nation to emphasize his radical dissent. with the mainstream of America. So Marable argues persuasively that those chapters were left aside. He had a chance to take a gander at them in Detroit. They are in the possession of attorney Gregory Reed there, and Marable was allowed to look at them for all of 15 minutes, but he could determine by looking at them that they looked like Malcolm's work and read like Malcolm's work. And the autobiography doesn't present those chapters and therefore doesn't ultimately present Malcolm X in the fullness of his radical beliefs in America.
So,
because Haley wanted to present a different kind of Malcolm.
So Haley had some – I mean, Haley's been criticized before for allegedly fabricating part of Roots. So his legacy, you know, is, I guess, really in question now, right?
Well, yeah. Well, he was accused of, you know, borrowing – plagiarizing from Courlander's work, and he settled, I believe, out of court. Of course, the broader stroke of his Roots story remains unassailed because of the power of that narrative. But in regard to Malcolm X, certainly every author has an agenda in mind. And that's not to exempt Malcolm X himself from his own agenda within an autobiographical narrative. All of us who write stories and memories recall for particular purposes, through particular lenses, with certain ends in mind. And the past is ever-changing. As Faulkner said, it ain't even past. So the problem is that it keeps getting reinvented. Why did Frederick Douglass write three autobiographies? Wow.
we have only about a minute left. We're not going to be able to give enough time to the new revelations of more personal reasons that Malcolm had for leaving the Nation of Islam in 1964, according to the book, previously attributed to theological and political reasons. Malcolm's 64 trip to Mecca, of course, well chronicled, but the new book describes two later trips to Africa and the Middle East that were also extremely influential in his worldview. And you know, finally, there's the Manning Marable story itself. He died on Friday just before the release of the book. You want to take your last 45 seconds here to deal with any of that, including maybe how Marable influenced your own work?
Well, look, the book is phenomenal because it gives us a completely different picture of Malcolm X, more complicated, more full, a fuller view of his legacy, his ideological trajectory, his evolution. In his own autobiography, Malcolm says, "They won't let me, turn the corner." And they being the people who were invested in his earlier vision as a fire-breathing anti-white person when indeed he accepted the humanity of all people. Manning Marable is one of the great intellectuals of our time, one of the great historians and political strategists. He was both a scholar and activist. Long before the term public intellectual became au courant, Manning Marable proved to us just how brilliantly they could be seamlessly joined together, and he shall be sorely missed.
Michael Eric Dyson, Georgetown professor, author of Making Malcolm, talking about Manning Marable's new book, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. We so appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.